Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is When God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go over on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it'll come. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, "Shoot it!" So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Styles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
All right, today, this podcast was inspired from a couple of back and forth text messages between myself and a high school friend of mine on opportunity. Now, the follow what I'm doing is, number one, if you go to our Facebook page, if you go to our Facebook page, which is our Facebook page is DIY Housing TV. Go to our Facebook page, which is DIY Housing TV, and then scroll down just a little bit. You're going to see, I just posted this a few minutes ago, two maps, and they're colored in orange and red. Okay, so we're going to be talking about today nine states chess, geography versus opportunity chess, and electoral college chess. And the root of this back and forth that me and this high school friend of mine, we were, you know, on a couple of short text messages is, I'm a big believer in there's more opportunity in small communities, and he believes that there are more opportunities in larger cities. All right. So I'm using the chessboard, the game of chess, and I've got three different types of chess that we'll be talking about today. Because what I like about the board game of chess is to become good at that game, the first skill that you really need to learn is the board, which represents the landscape, all right? And I believe that you really can recognize what an opportunity is until you recognize the landscape of wherever you are at right now as far as physical, real-life geography is. I mean, you know, California, Moscow, Timbuktu, you know, Serengeti. You know, what's the real chessboard of real living? So, there are different ways to play chess, but we're going to be talking about nine states chess, geography versus opportunity chess, in electoral college chess. So we'll be back in a few minutes, and we're going to get into it. But once again, go to our Facebook page, which is DIY Housing TV on Facebook, and then scroll down. You're looking for two maps, and they're in orange and red.
That's what we're going to go by. And what I'm saying is there's more opportunity in small places than they are in large or more densely populated areas. So whatever side you're on, 619-768-2945, that's the call-in number if you want to get in on this. Once again, 619-768-2945. We'll be back after this.
Hey, everyone. This is Kevin from thechesswebsite.com, and today I'm going to be covering my favorite topic in chess, and that is chess gambits. Ever since I was a kid, I loved playing chess gambits. Could be because Gambit was my favorite character on X-Men cartoons, or it could be because I loved giving up material in chess and then almost turning it into a puzzle. How can I give up material and then find an advantage for my setup? I just love that. So I made a video on my top eight favorite chess gambits. Now, it is subjective, so I want to give you the criteria that went into it. The first one is how often you're going to get to play this gambit. There's some obscure gambits that people like out there, but they just never come up. I like gambits that I can play anytime I want to because the positions are always coming up in my chess games. And the next one is how much fun the gambit is. I like to look at my opponent's face and just have them confused, trying to figure out why in the world I would play the moves that I'm making. So hopefully you guys enjoy this video. If you have other gambits that you really, really like, feel free to put those in the comment section below. But I think you'll find some on this video that you may not be familiar with. Also, for the first time in 10 years, we're going to try this out. If you wouldn't mind subscribing to the channel if you're not already and hitting the like button. Again, first time in 10 years, hundreds of videos, never asked for people to do that. But just curious to see how many people we can actually like this video and subscribe to the channel. So without further ado, hopefully you guys enjoy my top 8 chess gambits. Coming in at number 8, we have the Schliemann Gambit, which starts out with the Ray Lopez with e4, e5, knight f3, knight c6, bishop to b5. And usually in the Ray Lopez, black's looking to play a6, looking to play knight to f6. But in the Schliemann Gambit, black plays f5, says, I'm going to completely disrupt everything white is looking to do. White can't continue in the same game plan. How do they really continue from here? It looks logical to take this material. That's completely fine. It's what black wants. Black can now push forward with e4. This knight can't come to g5 or h4. It's just going to fall to the queen. If it comes back to g1, that feels really weird. All of a sudden you have d1. The bishop can take here on f5. So all in all, white doesn't have nearly the setup that they were hoping for in the Ray Lopez. All of a sudden, black is really looking to dominate the center of the board. So if you haven't played the Schliemann Gambit, it is a fun way to counter the Ray Lopez. Coming in at number 7, we have the Tennyson Gambit, which starts out with e4, d5. And I feel like any time black plays this, they almost for sure know that white's going to take here on d5. But what if they don't? What if they play...
And now, an exclusive first look at the upcoming documentary, 7 a.m.
Because true economic science is a branch of military science. War and money go hand in hand. Most wars are fights so people can make more money, and war is money. That means what? That the European American is not about to prepare black children to compete with his children for control of the economic sector. It's not going to happen. So if black people want this science, we got to teach it, we got to study it, and we're going to have to make some mistakes in perfecting it because we're still babies in the water of global economic commerce. As African people, we are financially illiterate. So we should not be surprised that we're so economically backward because we were never taught how to be economically forward. Our education in America has not provided or prepared us to be able to compete with Europeans economically. The historically black college was designed to do what? Teach you how to work for white people. Public schools, charter schools, parochial schools, independent schools. What is the purpose of education in America for black children right now? To teach them how to make a living working for white people. But I don't want the kids coming to my school to be going to class thinking that I'm learning this so I can go and get paid by a white person. They're going to be empowered to start their own business. When they leave that school, they're going to go into business. And why do we need our people to be self-sufficient? Because when you're not self-sufficient, you can't speak your mind. One of the biggest reasons why black people have been so cowardly in the post-civil rights movement, not standing up for ourselves, standing up for our children, standing up against police brutality. We're scared to lose our jobs. We have to work. We got kids. I can't talk about the racism on my job. I might lose it. So the reason why we're not speaking our mind is because we don't have economic freedom. As Mr. Garvey said, Marcus Garvey said, that a solid racial program must be built on a solid economic foundation. Show me your economic condition, and I'll show you your political condition. The political economy of the black community rests on the premise that because they do not make their own money, they are enslaved to Europeans. And as a result of that, they will never be able to do what needs to be done to carve out a future for their children, because the hand that pays is also the hand that rules them.
All right, today, we got a long title here. We're going to be discussing, and this is, like I say, this podcast was inspired by a little back and forth debate that a friend of mine from high school, we've had it two or three or four times, usually by text, that he believes that there's more opportunity, and probably most people do think like he thinks, because I guess this could be subjective depending on what metrics you use. He believes there's more opportunity in big cities, and I believe the 180 of that, there's more opportunity in small places. So today's podcast is titled, because I'm using three different metrics on this, nine states chess, geography versus opportunity chess, and the electoral college chess. And the common denominator with all these metrics is the chessboard, because the chessboard represents the landscape. And I believe in real life, if you know the landscape, you can identify where opportunities are. All right, so let's start with a little guide here, and I've added an extra map on here. If you go to our Facebook page, our Facebook page is DIY Housing TV, DIY Housing TV. Scroll down, and I've added an extra map, so it's three maps that we're going to be looking at. Now, the first map is a map that's in orange and red, and it's the red states are, this is not blue and red, but this is red and orange. The red states are the nine largest states in the United States by population. Out of the 50 states, then hold on, wait a minute. Wait a minute, somebody's calling me. Hold on.
Hello friends, this is Dijin Jayas from Online Chess Lessons. Today we are going to look at the top 10 defenses for black. On number 10, we have the Russian system, or we call it as the Petrov defense. Starts out with pawn to e4, black has pawn e5, knight f3, knight f6. We can see that both knights are attacking the pawns on e4 and e5 of the opponent. The main line goes like knight to e5. In this position, the black knight has got a tendency to capture the pawn on e4. If he captures, this is a big blunder. After queen e2, knight goes back to, say, f6 again, then the discovered check. And we're going to lose our queen. So, the best response from black after n into e5 is d3. The knight goes back to nf3 again, then black knight is going to capture the pawn on e4. Then queen comes to e2, queen e7, then b3, knight f6, Queen captures queen. Bishop captures queen. Bishop e2. Castling. Castling. This petrol defense is a drawish line, actually. Both players play correctly. Not much attacking chances for black. On number 9, we have the Dutch defense. It starts off with pawn to d4, then plays f5. This is a very interesting move from black. Black actually trying to protect the square, preventing e4 push from the white side. And the main line goes like knight c3, pawn e6, supporting the pawn on f5. Then g3 from white, trying to bring this bishop into this long diagonal. Then nf6, getting more control over these two squares. So overall, this is a good defense for black. This has been played by most of the top level players. The world champion Magnus Carlsen plays this defense very often. So it's a very good defense for black. Next we have the Caro-Kann defense. Starts out with e4 and black responds c6. Then after d4, trying to control the center by the white pieces, then comes d5 attacking the center from black. If white tries to hold the center, then he may play knight c3. Then black can simply capture the pawn on e4. Knight recaptures. Then bishop f5. Knight g3 attacks the bishop. Then bishop g6. When we look at the black's position, black's light square bishop is well placed. And he is attacking this pawn on c2. And we can always attack this pawn on d4 by this e5 push, and this is going to be a good defense for black. On number 6, we have the French defense. Starts out with e4, black's going to respond e6. Then after d4, d5, attacking the center. White may play e5, then we're going to play c5, attacking the center pawn. Then if white captures, we're going to capture with the bishop. And we analyze the position. We got a minor piece of bishop is developed and is holding this long diagonal and attaching this weak pawn near the king. This is going to be very good for black. On number 6, we have the Alexandre defense. Starts out with pawn to e4. Black's going to play knight f6. You can see there right away, black piece is attacking the e4 pawn. The main line starts out with pushing the pawn again to e5, chasing the knight. It's going to play in d5, then d4 from white. From here, black can simply push the pawn, attacking the center piece, this pass pawn. And we can see another pawn push, c4 from white, attacking the knight again. The knight's going to play in b6, then f4 from white. Look at the position, we can see that white's pieces are controlling the center of the ball. But it's not easy for white to play in this position, because after g5, white has to respond brilliantly in this position. Because if he takes, you're going to capture the e5 pawn, captures again, now d6. These three isolated pawns are very difficult for white to hold on, and this is a great advantage for black. On number 5, we have the King's Indian defense. Starts out with pawn to d4. Nf6, c4, then g6. After nc3, bishop g7, bishop f4, castling. This setup is what we call as the King's Indian defense. Throughout the game, black is going to respond to white's moves and white's plans. It's a passive setup opening, and it's very difficult for white to find any sort of advantage in this opening. Black will be later on trying to attack through the king's side. White will be trying to attack through the queen's side. White has to know a lot of lines to play to get any sort of advantage in this position if black plays correctly in this defense. Next, we're going to see the Ravage defense. Start out with e4, g6, d4, and c5. You can see that black is giving up a pawn to get the center from white. If white decides to capture the pawn, you can simply bring our queen to a5 check. We can see bd2, then we can recapture the pawn. In this position, white may play some development moves like bishop d3 or nf3, or you can see even nc3. And in this position, black can bring his bishop to this long diagonal here, controlling this long diagonal, and white may play bishop e2, then we can develop our knight, nf6, then nf3, castling. This is a good setup for black and white pieces as well. We are going to attack the center with this d5 move in the next move, and we're going to completely destroy your center and counterplay later on in the game. On number 3, we have the Sicilian defense. Starts with e4, c5. This is a very sharper line. There are a lot of theories and complications behind this defense. If you are playing with black, you need to know all these things. You must know every details of this defense. Otherwise, you'll find it very difficult to play against white. White is simply playing the normal moves, some development moves, and attack later on the game. Black needs to know how to develop this position, what are the different variations. This defense is played in IGM levels, top level tournaments. This is a very good opening for white if you know all the variations and theories behind this. On number 2, we have the Ninzo Indian defense. This is a very good defense for black. The winning rate of black is very high. Starts with d4, nf6, then c4, e6, nc3, then bishop to b4. Bishop b4 is pinning this knight, and after bf4, our dark square bishop is going to capture the knight, and pawn captures back. Now black castles. When we evaluate this position, white has got a double pawn here. This has always become a weakness for white. After nf3, b6, e3, then bb7, controlling this long diagonal by this bishop. Then white's gonna play b2, d6, castling, knight bd7. This is a very good position for black, and white's weakness is having the double pawn on the c5. So black can exploit this opportunity and can attack through the queen's egg if he wants to, or he can bring all his pieces the king side and attack on the king side if he wants to. And overall, this is a very good defense for black. On number 1, we have the Perk defense. Starts with e4, d6, d4, nf6, nc3, supporting this pawn, which is attacked by this knight. Then comes g6, then f4, this is the principal move from white, then bg7, trying to control this long diagonal, then nf3 from white, and black castles. This is a very solid position for black. Black is now trying to attack the center early on in the game. He is trying to make a solid position, safety for his king, and after that trying to attack the center, white is simply going to develop his bishop. Say bd3, then knight to bd7, then black square bishop to e3, then light square bishop is a major issue in this position. Then we can simply open up a small diagonal for our bishop. Bishop is going to come to B2, then control this long diagonal and have an attack later on in this game. Overall, this is a very good defense for black. This pro defense is played by top level players in top level tournaments, grandmasters. They all prefer this pro defense because of this high winning rate. I'll be doing a video regarding the variations that can be played in the pro defense. Also, I'll be doing videos regarding all the openings that I showed before you in detail. So please do subscribe my channel. Please let me know if you have any doubts or any comments on this video.
Okay. I had to take a break there. Not emergency, but urgent. Okay, so nine states chess, geography versus opportunity chess, and the electoral college chess. That's what we're talking about today. This ties into what we're doing offline with building stuff. But anyway, let's start off with nine states chess. All right, so if you go to our Facebook page, which is DIY Housing TV, I have three maps. The first map, which is in orange and red, you see the nine largest states by population. All right, that's the metric we're going by. The nine largest states by population. Now, this friend of mine from high school believes that these are parts of the United States that have the most opportunity, okay? I'm the polar opposite of that. I believe that the orange areas have the most opportunity. So I guess it's very subjective on how you look at it and what metrics you're using. All right, so let's look at the nine. Now, the nine states are starting out in California, Texas in the Southwest, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, Illinois. You also have Ohio, Pennsylvania, and New York. All right. Those are the nine largest states out of 50 in the United States. Now, do these places have the most opportunities, or is something different? And opportunities, I think, in the context that he mentioned, the metrics that he's using would be jobs, housing, that, you know, whatever else his metrics might be. Well, let's take a look at these. Let's look at some common denominators here. Let's go with the majority of the, and there are nine of these, there are nine of them, so they are, once again, from nine on up to one. North Carolina is number nine, Georgia's number eight, coming in at number seven is Ohio, then Illinois is number six, Pennsylvania's number five, New York is number four, Florida is number three, Texas is number two, and California is number one. All right, now let's just do some common sense visual stuff here. North Carolina, Georgia, Pennsylvania, New York, and Florida. That's one, two, three, four. Oh, hold up. All right. North Carolina, one, two, three, four. Oh, yeah, five, excuse me. North Carolina, Georgia, North Carolina, Georgia is one, two. New York is four. Four is five. So over 50%, five out of these nine most populated states, over 50% of that They're on the eastern seaboard. They're on the east coast. Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and New York State are all on the east coast. So my argument is that it's not so much they have the most opportunities, but if you look at how this nation was formed, some of these states were part of the original 13 colonies, number one. And when there was European settlement, well, the first thing they didn't come in from the West. They came in from Europe. They came from across the pond. So they ended up in Florida and on the East Coast, on the Eastern Seaboard. So there's been over 200, almost 250 years, not quite 250 yet, but it's been over 200 years that people have been coming from Europe and other parts of the world, and they just geographically, the first stop they hit, the shores of the United States, would be those areas. So it's not so much because they had the most opportunity. And once again, we're looking at it, he's looking at it from a European perspective, because there were Native Americans already in these places before Europeans even touched foot in what we now call the United States. But as far as the United States population goes, this is where they landed first. All right. Slave ships dropped off cargo, Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas. It was just, it's not like their destination was Alaska or California. And if we look at it, once again, there are 10 of them here out of the most populated 9. North Carolina, East Coast. Georgia, East Coast. Ohio, Midwest, but here's some common denominators here. North Carolina, Georgia, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, and Florida all share the same time zone, Eastern time zone. So that's out of 9, you got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You have 6 of the 9 states, which are the most populated states, all share the same time zone. Not so much because they have more opportunity. It's because, number one, that's where people touch down first, East Coast. Now, Ohio is considered Midwest, so when people felt there was a little bit too much of a crowd where they were in the East, you know, they started moving out west. So that includes Illinois, which is in the central time zone, and then Texas is in the central time zone, Illinois, Texas, and Ohio. All right. Illinois is in central time zone, and Texas, the majority of the state of Texas is in the central time zone, except for El Paso, which is in the mountain time zone. So out of the 9 most populated states, okay, they're either in the eastern time zone or the central time zone. There's nothing in red. In mountain time and in Pacific time, you have one state, that's California. All right. Now, let's see what else we have here. Okay. Now, Another map that we have here is the 144 largest counties by population in the United States versus 2,998 counties were the smallest counties by population in the United States. And you see the ones in red. Those are largest by population. And you see the rest is in orange. I'm saying, now he would say, that there's more opportunity in the red counties. And I'm saying there's more opportunity in the orange counties. And then there's one other map. It says America's empty Southwest. Only 2% of this country's 330 million people, only 2% live, and you see it right there, about geographically half of Texas, all of New Mexico, about maybe 50% or 60%, I don't know, 50% or so of, Arizona, you got parts of Utah and Colorado, Oklahoma, and part of Kansas. Only 2%. I'm saying for the average American, now once again, this is very subjective, there's more opportunity these across the board, in my opinion, and I'm going to explain why. Where the 2% is, which would be yellow or orange, excuse me, in these pictures versus the red. And once again, this is, I'm very subjective when I come to my metrics. So me and my high school buddy, we have different metrics. Now, let's take a look at, let's start with Florida. Florida has 67 counties. And the most populated of those counties, and I'm going to go by cities, Dade County, which has Dade and Broward. Broward has Fort Lauderdale. Dade has Miami, primarily. So that's two counties out of 67. You have Pinellas and Hillsborough County. That's where Tampa and St. Pete is. You have Orange County, where Orlando is. And you have Duval, where Jacksonville is. So let's see. There's Dade, Broward, Pinellas, Hillsborough, Duval, five counties. Yet you've got 67 counties in the state of Florida. So now in those most populated counties, you have higher crime rates. You have more people in those places claiming discrimination, claiming redlining. Well, this basically goes back to this is economics 101, first week in class, supply and demand. There's more affordable housing all throughout the state of Florida. Once again, Florida's got 67 counties. So there's at least 60 counties where you can find affordable housing. There's 60 counties where it'll be easier to get a job. Okay? There'll be 60 counties where, you know, there's just more positivity if you go to these smaller places. All these smaller places have jobs. All these smaller places have affordable housing. All these smaller places is just less scare. I mean, there's scarcity. There are more abundant opportunities. Whereas with the more, once again, when you go to a more densely populated area, then scarcity comes into effect. while you think you're going there because optically it seems like there's more opportunity, you're really going into a place of scarcity because there are more people, there's more competition fighting for those jobs. You know, there are more people that want a place to stay. Comes in, supply and demand comes in, prices go up, and they go up in price. Oh, wait a minute. I can rent a whole house for $100. Well, wait a minute, but that was yesterday. Now we've got 10 more people that want to rent the same house. So, you know, instead of selling for $100, you know, I'm going up to $200. Price jumped by, you know, 100%. Whereas outside of those areas, their jobs, there's housing, there's real affordable housing, but are you willing to drive an extra 20 minutes or 30 minutes or an hour or what have you for, you know, jobs in or what have you? So there's more opportunity, the way I see it. Okay. Now, let's see. What other metrics do we have here? A number of these states, let's go back to our list here, of the nine states. How many are east of the Mississippi? Once again, we started on the East Coast building this country, not the West Coast. They didn't come from the South. They didn't come from the North. They came from the Atlantic Ocean mostly. That's how this country was basically built, coming from the Atlantic coast, the Atlantic Ocean. So east of the Mississippi, we have North Carolina, Georgia, Ohio. We have Pennsylvania. We have New York, Florida. Okay, so we have 1, 2, 3. And let me look at, I just want to make sure my geography is right. Okay, let's see, Mississippi River. Where the Mississippi River, okay. All right, states on the Mississippi River. We have, I just got to double check. Okay, the vision slings. Okay, wait a minute. What am I? Okay. All right, the Mississippi. All right, okay, I got a map here. Okay, I got what I was looking for. Okay, so out of the nine largest, most populous states, North Carolina, see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Seven of the nine most populated states of the Union are east of the Mississippi. Only Texas and California are west of the Mississippi. So two common denominators, number one, time zone, the most dominant time zone of the most populated areas of the United States are in the Eastern time zone. Number two, They're all except for two states are east of the Mississippi. Only two are west of the Mississippi. All right. And matter of fact, I would say when it comes to New York, we're only talking about one heavily populated area. That's New York City. Because New York State, to a high degree, is rural. You got Buffalo and Rochester and Niagara Falls, those places. But for the most part, New York State is rural. Matter of fact, 97% of the United States is rural. That's just overall. So now, I also mentioned, let's see, Electoral College. Let's see, we got the time zones. Okay. Well, let's look it up again. Electoral College, largest states. Okay, and they are, okay, well, let's see what the National Archives has to say about this. So the way I look at things is, point of view, well, let's say with affordable housing, there's more affordable housing. It's easy to find an affordable house in the orange spot spaces of the United States versus the red spaces, states. And even within the red states, if you can avoid the most densely populated, once you get outside of, let's say, Broward County, Dade County, Pinellas and Hillsborough County, Jacksonville, which is Duval County, once you get outside of those areas, there's a lot of affordable housing in the state of Florida. In California, once you get outside of Los Angeles, San Francisco, San Diego, those high rent places, once you get outside of those major metro areas, there's plenty of affordable housing. There's plenty of land that you can buy at affordable rates. I was looking for it. Toro. No, that's not right. Okay, we may have to cover that on another day, but if you look at, the most important thing is, number one, people came in and they gravitated to, wherever the boat was dropping them off at from the Atlantic Ocean, that's why you have more heavily populated states at the extreme East Coast, but a little spill over to the Midwest, like Ohio, Illinois, versus the majority of the country. But if you look at Walmart, Bentonville, Arkansas, not a big place. And if you look at where a lot of billionaires started their businesses, You know, they didn't sort them in these big gargantuan metro areas. Now, there are some exceptions that they started in a garage. Okay. But they weren't getting, you know, renting out office space downtown or nothing like that. So it all depends on how you look at it. If you're looking for a job, then you might think, you know what, the big city is a place for me. But I'm saying even if you're looking for a job, go look at the small companies in the small towns and villages. It's easier to get on there because there's more of them, there's more opportunity, and you can go from there. All right. We'll come back and cover more of this later on. But know the landscape. Know the landscape. And once again, it all depends on what metrics that you're using, because obviously me and my high school friend, he's using one set of metrics and I'm using another set of metrics. You know, so you can't use one set of metrics. Now, it's not one size fits all. Okay, now we got a doghouse meeting tonight. So before we go out here, we're going to play our solar cabin audio. If it would queue up. Here we go.
Hi, folks. In this video, I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it, and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre. And that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get this piece of property from family. It was willed to me when my father passed away. But I have also purchased small pieces of property like this for under $400. I have an acre down in Arizona near Sholo, Arizona that I purchased for under $400. I have 5 acres near El Paso, Texas that I purchased for under $700. So it's very easy to find a piece of land if you do some looking around. eBay is a good source for finding land. Tax sales are a good source for finding land. Family members may want to sell off a piece of land. Go around looking in rural areas and maybe you'll find a farmer that wants to split off a small piece of land and would gladly sell you one. You don't have to spend a lot of money on land. Okay? This is land that doesn't have utilities run to it. It doesn't have a blacktop road that runs into it or driveway. It's rough land. That's what you start with usually if you want to buy a small piece of land that you're going to homestead on. After you have your piece of land, then you're going to have a house. You can have a big house like most people live in, and you can pay a lot of money for it and have a mortgage and be a slave to the system for another 30 years, or you can decide if you'd like to build a smaller house like mine. Paid for with cash. This is my solar cabin. The cabin cost me $2,000 to build. That does not include the doors and windows, which I salvaged off of a trailer that was being torn down. For the cabin, it cost me $2,000. It is 14 by 14. Downstairs is living area, dining area, bathroom, kitchen. Upstairs, I have a loft, bedroom, and an office. In my other videos, I take you on a complete walkthrough of this cabin, so watch those if you want to see how the cabin is as large as it is and functional on the inside. Up there on my roof, you see my solar panels. That's a 350-watt solar system that provides all of my electricity needs for lights, TVs, water pumps, all miscellaneous gadget, laptop, TV, run my vacuum, and everything else off of a 350-watt system. That 350-watt system cost me under $3,000. $2,000 for the cabin, $3,000 for the power system of solar electricity, and I use propane. I have a propane tank in the back of the cabin, and I have a propane furnace, fridge, stove, and on-demand water heater, and those cost me just about $200 for an entire year. And we have cold winters here, folks. Under $200 for an entire year for all of my propane. That is the only utility bill I have. I do not pay for electricity. I do not pay for water because I drilled my own water well. Before I drilled my own water well, though, I hauled water in. But drilling a water well on a piece of property is not that hard. You can either do it yourself or hire somebody to do it. So I have no monthly utility bills. I have a house that's completely paid for. And I have freedom. A freedom that you can't get when you're under the pressure of a mortgage and utility bills. I want you to take just a minute and think about what you could do with your life if you had no house payments and no utility bills. And I'm telling you, it is completely possible. I'm not going to go into any details of how to get out of the house that you're in. You're going to have to figure that out and talk to some professionals for some help that way. All I'm here to do is tell you it's completely possible. Now, some of you are looking at the cabin and saying, yeah, but I couldn't possibly live in anything that small. This cabin was designed specifically for additions to be built on any of three sides. As you can see, the cabin has no windows on any of the three sides. There is a window in the back door glass. The sides are 14 by 14. The cabin was built to have shed additions built on all three sides. This cabin is 400 square feet approximately inside with 200 square foot footprint. When you add on additions, you could add on an additional 400 square feet on either side and off the back, giving you anywhere from 800 to 1,200 square feet. The great thing about building a small cabin to start out with, though, is it gives you a place to live when you build on your additions, and that way you can wait and live very cheaply without any house payments or utility bills, and then when you have the money, you can build on the additions to expand the cabin. That's very good for a single person or a young couple who don't have children because you don't need a whole lot of space to start off with. This way you can save for it, build on as you want to, have the additions, have the extra room if that's what you want. Now, I live full-time in this cabin. I live by myself, but my girlfriend comes up here on the weekends, and we stay together, and let me tell you, it's perfectly comfortable. We don't feel cramped at all, and we'd much rather have a small place like this. It takes a lot less money to heat. It takes a lot less money to cool. It's a lot easier to clean. It's just a fantastic home. Now, I'm not trying to push you into building a home exactly like mine. I'm just trying to provide you with some ideas. If you wanted to come up with different ideas, a different plan, that's just fine by me. But if you are interested in learning how to build a home like mine, I do have an ebook available and a printed book available called Simple Solar Homesteading. Go to www.simplesolarhomesteading.com. You can learn how to build a cabin like mine or at least get some great ideas for building your own home. Now I want to repeat, I own my land. I have a house that I built for under $2,000. I have a solar electric system that I have for under $3,000. I use propane, which costs me under $200 a year. I have no house payments. I have no utility bills. If you want a life like this, it is very possible. You can stop listening to the media, and you can stop being put under society's pressures to live in the type of houses that everyone tells you you have to live in. You can live very inexpensively, and you can do this at any age, whether you're older or younger. If you're younger and you start in a place like this, imagine the amount of money that you would have to retire on with no house payments, no utility bills, and freedom. Thank you for joining me, folks. Please watch the rest of my videos for more detailed information on each of the
Solar Sister story is centered around the stories of our women entrepreneurs. So many kinds of women from all backgrounds and starting points have joined the Solar Sister. Our goal is to support them to create businesses that improve their families' lives and contribute to community development. One of these women is Juliet Mullen. Juliet has worked hard all her life farming, selling crops, and keeping the house for her husband and children. After decades of cooking over smoke fires and the laborious task of collecting wood, Juliet was suffering with health problems. And with no access to electricity, she also had to pay for kerosene and searchlight batteries. She found herself struggling to keep the family going and pay for her grandchildren to go to school. Her teenager granddaughter Rita was finishing primary school and dreamed of going to secondary school. In 2013, Juliet joined the Solar Sister, kicked off her clean energy business, and brought in some extra income. She also saved the money because she no longer paid for kerosene or batteries. With this small boost, she could pay school fees and take care of basic health needs. This story is important because it shows how Solar Sister is much more than just solar light. Each solar light, each clean stove, transforms a household, improving family health, children's education, women's status, and control over resources. Not to mention easing the environmental devastation that wood stove and kerosene lamps cause. It's good for everyone. So far, we have trained and supported over 3,000 entrepreneurs like Juliet. These entrepreneurs have reached over 1 million people in Uganda, Nigeria, and Tanzania with clean energy solutions. We are always trying to improve our model and reach more people through affordable lights and stores. But the problem is huge, and there is a lot of work to do. There are still 600 million Africans living without electricity. Solar Sister was created to support African women to both improve their own economic development and to bring sustainable energy solutions to their communities. We need your help to accomplish our plans to reach 5 times as many people with clean energy solutions. Join our women driving clean energy revolution.
Solar Now is a renewable energy company that began its operations in Uganda in 2011. It currently has 47 operational branches in Uganda and 9 operational branches in Kenya. Solar Now provides both small household systems which range from 50 watt peak to 200 watt peak and large home solar systems which range from 250 to 3 kilowatts. These are both used for domestic and commercial purposes. Solar Now has been able to transform the rural commercial farmers by bringing products like a water pump.
I'm a farmer at Mvubu Village, Narigasa sub-count, Niraka, in Chotera district. I have passion fruits, green peppers, I have coffee, oranges, and I have banana.
Put water in this pipe because it helps the other machine to start.
So after putting that into the water, we put this panel and we connect it on the machine so that it starts. This one, we connect it on the panel after we put on.
The water is going into the sprinklers, then the sprinklers will start irrigating.
So ever since I joined Solar Now Water Farm, I reduced on my workers. I used to spend 50,000 a day on 10 workers. But as for now, I am only spending just 10,000 on workers. Those 10 workers I had,
They used to irrigate using the watering cans. But now, the two workers I have, they only operate the Soya Now water farm. I irrigate every time I want to irrigate. The production increased two times. The passion fruit, you can see that they are very many on the plantation. They are very many. Since I go to the Soya Now water farm, I get time for my family. I used to spend the whole day in my garden, my Soya Now water farm, but now I can get time for my family.
Soya Now, in the process of transforming people's lives in Uganda, has now reached to 20,000 homesteads. We've served systems to 20,000 homesteads. And these are people who are largely initially off-grid.
When you buy it, you have 6 meters in sucking. You have a motor here, which enables it to run physically without you attempting to use it manually. It has a pack here for spares that you need in case you want to elongate the pipe for distribution, or in case you want to convert when you're using sprinklers. It also has a handle here in case you want to run it manually, and a panel here in case you want to use it on solar. This pump can actually use to a tune of 5 sprinklers in 5 meters of spacing. Above the ground, it can do a height of 10 meters. And then on a hilly sloping ground, it actually has a distance of travel of 150. Then on a flat land, it's going to do a distance of 300 meters. So if at all you buy it and you need it for a specific kind of irrigation in your garden, you have to put into consideration the different parameters of use.
When you buy a solar system from Soya Now, you have an opportunity of acquiring the system on either cash or credit. And the credit period is up to 2 years, depending on your financial muscle. But you have to pay a minimum of 15% of the total cost of the system. And the other benefit that the customer has from Soya Now is that we have a warranty of 2 years and a free maintenance and service of the system up to 5 years. In this period of 5 years, if your system got faulty, you get service at no cost. You don't need to pay. And at the same time, on top of that, when you buy the solar system from Soya Now, we give you free transportation. You don't need to pay for transportation. You don't need to pay for the installation. So all these are benefits that acquire a customer who buys the solar system from Soya Now gets.